Chapter 9. Patients have left the most fragmentary. This rich compensation is offered to the reader. There is hardly a conceivable subject in life or literature which they do not illustrate by striking aphorisms, by concise and profound observations, by wisdom ever applicable to the deeds of men, and by wit as available for their enjoyment. Nor, above all, will there anywhere be found a more pervading passion for liberty, a fiercer hatred of the base, a wider sympathy with the wronged and the oppressed, or help more ready at all times for those who fight at odds and disadvantage against the powerful and the fortunate, than in the writings of Walter Savage Landor. Last page of second volume. The impression was strong upon the present writer's mind, as on Mr. Forster's, during years of close friendship with the subject of this biography, that his animosities were chiefly referable to the singular inability in him to dissociate other people's ways of thinking from his own. He had, to the last, a ludicrous grievance. Both Mr. Forster and the writer have often amused themselves with it against a good-natured nobleman, doubtless perfectly unconscious of having ever given him offense. The offense was, that on the occasion of some dinner party in another nobleman's house, many years before, this innocent lord, then a commoner, had passed into dinner, through some door, before him, as he himself was about to pass in through that same door with a lady on his arm. Now, Landor was a gentleman of most scrupulous politeness, and in his carriage of himself towards ladies there was a certain mixture of stateliness and deference, belonging to quite another time, and, as Mr. Pepys would observe, mighty pretty to see. If he could by any effort imagine himself committing such a high crime and misdemeanor as that in question, he could only imagine himself as doing it of a set purpose, under the sting of some vast injury, to inflict a great affront. A deliberately designed affront on the part of another man, it therefore remained to the end of his days. The manner in which, as time went on, he permeated the unfortunate lord's ancestry with this offense, was whimsically characteristic of Landor. The writer remembers very well, when only the individual himself was held responsible in the story for the breach of good breeding, but in another 10 years or so, it began to appear that his father had always been remarkable for ill manners, and in yet another 10 years or so, his grandfather developed into quite a prodigy of coarse behavior. Mr. Boythorn, if he may again be quoted, said of his adversary, Sir Leicester Dedlock, "That fellow is, and his father was, and his grandfather was, the most stiff-necked, arrogant, imbecile, pig-headed numbskull, ever, by some inexplicable mistake of nature, born in any station of life, but a walking sticks." The strength of some of Mr. Landor's most captivating kind qualities was traceable to the same source. Knowing how keenly he himself would feel the being at any small social disadvantage, or the being unconsciously placed in any ridiculous light, he was wonderfully considerate of shy people, or of such as might be below the level of his usual conversation, or otherwise out of their element. The writer once observed him in the keenest distress of mind in behalf of a modest young stranger who came into a drawing room with a glove on his head. An expressive commentary on this sympathetic condition, and on the delicacy with which he advanced to the young stranger's rescue, was afterwards furnished by himself at a friendly dinner at Gore House, when it was the most delightful of houses. His dress, say, his cravat or shirt collar had become slightly disarranged on a hot evening, and Count d'Orsay laughingly called his attention to the circumstance as we rose from table. Landor became flushed, and greatly agitated. "My dear Count d'Orsay, I thank you. My dear Count d'Orsay, I thank you from my soul for pointing out to me the abominable condition to which I am reduced. If I had entered the drawing room, and presented myself before Lady Blessington in so absurd a light, I would have instantly gone home, put a pistol to my head, and blown my brains out." Mr. Forster tells a similar story of his keeping a company waiting dinner, through losing his way, and of his seeing, no remedy for, that breach of politeness, but cutting his throat, or drowning himself, unless a countryman whom he met could direct him by a short road to the house where the party were assembled. Surely these are expressive notes on the gravity and reality of his explosive inclinations to kill kings. His manner towards boys was charming, and the earnestness of his wish to be on equal terms with them and to win their confidence was quite touching. Few, reading Mr. Forster's book, can fall to see in this his pensive remembrance of that studious willful boy at once shy and impetuous, who had not many intimacies at Rugby, but who was generally popular and respected, and used his influence often to save the younger boys from undue harshness or violence. The impulsive yearnings of his passionate heart towards his own boy, on their meeting at Bath, after years of separation, likewise burned through this phase of his character. But a more spiritual, softened, and unselfish aspect of it was to derive from his respectful belief in happiness which he himself had missed. His marriage had not been a felicitous one, that may be fairly assumed for either side, but no trace of bitterness or distrust concerning other marriages was in his mind. He was never more serene than in the midst of a domestic circle, and was invariably remarkable for a perfectly benignant interest in young couples and young lovers. That, in his ever-fresh fancy, he conceived in this association innumerable histories of himself involving far more unlikely events that never happened than Isaac Disraeli ever imagined, is hardly to be doubted. But as to this part of his real history, he was mute, or revealed his nobleness in an impulse to be generously just. We verge on delicate ground, but a slight remembrance rises in the writer which can grate nowhere. Mr. Forster relates how a certain friend, being in Florence, sent him home a leaf from the garden of his old house at Fiesole. That friend had first asked him what he should send him home, and he had stipulated for this gift found by Mr. Forster among his papers after his death. The friend, on coming back to England, related to Lander that he had been much embarrassed, on going in search of the leaf, by his driver suddenly stopping his horses in a narrow lane, and presenting him, the friend, to La Signora Landora. The lady was walking alone on a bright Italian winter day, and the man, having been told to drive to the Villa Landora, inferred that he must be conveying a guest or visitor. "I pulled off my hat," said the friend, apologized for the coachman's mistake, and drove on. The lady was walking with a rapid and firm step, had bright eyes, a fine fresh color, and looked animated and agreeable. Lander checked off each clause of the description with a stately nod of more than ready assent, and replied, with all his tremendous energy concentrated into the sentence, "And the Lord forbid that I should do otherwise than declare that she always was agreeable to everyone but me." Mr. Forster step by step builds up the evidence on which he writes this life and states this character. In like manner, he gives the evidence for his high estimation of Lander's works, and it may be added for their recompense against some neglect, in finding so sympathetic, acute, and devoted a champion. Nothing in the book is more remarkable than his examination of each of Lander's successive pieces of writing, his delicate discernment of their beauties, and his strong desire to impart his own perceptions in this wise to the great audience that is yet to come. It rarely befalls an author to have such a commentator, to become the subject of so much artistic skill and knowledge, combined with such infinite and loving pains, alike as a piece of biography and as a commentary upon the beauties of a great writer. The book is a massive book, as the man and the writer were massive too. Sometimes, when the balance held by Mr. Forster has seemed for a moment to turn a little heavily against the infirmities of temperament of a grand old friend, we have felt something of a shock, but we have not once been able to gainsay the justice of the scales. This feeling too has only fluttered out of the detail here or there, and has vanished before the whole. We fully agree with Mr. Forster that judgment has been passed as it should be, with an equal desire to be only just on all the qualities of his temperament which affected necessarily not his own life only, But, now that the story is told, no one will have difficulty in striking the balance between its good and ill, and what was really imperishable in Lander's genius will not be treasured less, or less understood, for the more perfect knowledge of his character. Mr. Forster's second volume gives a facsimile of Lander's writing at 75. It may be interesting to those who are curious in calligraphy to know that its resemblance to the recent handwriting of that great genius, M. Victor Hugo, is singularly strong. In a military burial ground in India, the name of Walter Lander is associated with the present writers over the grave of a young officer. No name could stand there, more inseparably associated in the writer's mind with the dignity of generosity. With a noble scorn of all littleness, all cruelty, oppression, fraud, and false pretense. Address which appeared shortly previous to the completion of the 20th volume, 1868, intimating a new series of All the Year Round. I beg to announce to the readers of this journal that on the completion of the 20th volume on the 28th of November, in the present year, I shall commence an entirely new series of All the Year Round. The change is not only due to the convenience of the public with which a set of such books, extending beyond 20 large volumes, would be quite incompatible, but is also resolved upon for the purpose of effecting some desirable improvements in respect of type, paper, and size of page, which could not otherwise be made. To the literature of the new series it would not become me to refer, beyond glancing at the pages of this journal, and of its predecessor, through a score of years, inasmuch as my regular fellow laborers, and I will be at our old posts, in company with those younger comrades, whom I have had the pleasure of enrolling from time to time, and whose number it is always one of my pleasantest editorial duties to enlarge. As it is better that every kind of work honestly undertaken and discharged should speak for itself than be spoken for, I will only remark further on one intended omission in the new series. The extra Christmas number has now been so extensively, and regularly, and often imitated, that it is in very great danger of becoming tiresome. I have therefore resolved, though I cannot add, willingly, to abolish it, at the highest tide of its success. Charles Dickens. Footnotes. 1. Walter Savage Lander. A Biography, by John Forster, 2 vols. Chapman and Hall. End of Project Gutenberg. A text of contributions to All the Year Round. Allure by Gutenberg Edition.